This is Abdullah Samir. I'm joined by a very special guest today by the name of John. How do I say your last name? Delvento?
Delvento, you got it.
Alrighty. So John is a convert to Islam and also an ex-Muslim. So he came into Islam and he left Islam. Kind of like myself, if you consider that I converted to Sunni Islam. So we're going to have some similarities there. Because I also went through the whole conversion thing. And so I think it's going to be a very interesting conversation. How's it going, John?
It's going well. I do come from the worst of both worlds. Yes, I converted to Islam. I grew up in like the traditional kind of American stereotypical conservative Christian background. I did end up leaving Islam for various reasons. I participated in a very interesting sect of Islam, and I love religion. I love deep discussions. It's always been a part of my life, and this is like the first time I've kind of spoken, you know, publicly about it. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. It's going well here, and you know, the weather's getting a little better. Spring is basically here where I'm at, so it's nice, and I do appreciate, you know, being able to talk about this.
As we were having a conversation on Twitter, music is a very big part of your life as well. So we're going to talk about that as well, and how that caused a sort of change in your direction of your life as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a full-time composer. That's my job. I write music mainly for TV shows and ads. Basically, about 50 shows right now I'm writing music for. You know, if you're watching The Bachelor right now, I am providing music for that show. So, you know, it's a big part of my life. It is how I make my income. It's a hustle for me. And, you know, when I was in Islam, kind of, you know, blending those two was very difficult. It's a topic that's not spoken a lot about, the quote-unquote Islamic views of music. There is one side that has a very strong opinion in a lot of YouTube videos about it, but there is a rich Islamic history of music as well. So, you know, but that also was one of the reasons why I left, because it is part of my life. It is my livelihood. And I bet a lot of the listeners here have probably heard my music sometime, you know, on some show. So, you know, I kind of just work in the shadows, though, but it is a really big part of my life. And I love doing it. I love music. It's basically the only thing I know how to do. So, you know, having some Muslims tell me that it's haram was kind of, you know, ridiculous. But I'm sure we'll end up talking about that.
Okay, awesome. So let's start at the beginning then. So your background, you said tell us about your Christian background. You're born as a Christian, I guess, or your family is Christian.
Yeah, so when I say stereotypical American conservative Christian, maybe if anybody doesn't know what that might mean, if you maybe think back to the George Bush eras, there was a stereotype of like the evangelical Christian. And that's basically, you know, my family's background. We come from Connecticut, which is a very kind of colonial state, you know, kind of a 17th century American kind of Puritan pilgrim area, kind of, you know, the stereotypical white steeple church, you know, the community church, the congregational church, you know, very, very old kind of American traditional, you know, mom and dad and their one kid going to church on a Sunday with a suit and tie. And, you know, I was really into it. That was my whole upbringing. It was a very strong Christian upbringing. It was part of our family life, part of our culture, our bonding, our morality. I enjoyed those times. In high school, I was a very active kind of, you know, evangelical, born-again Christian. And so, you know, that was a big part of my life. And, of course, you know, I, you know, went through the college phase and you know, ended up, you know, kind of getting into the wave of the new atheist, which when I went to college, you know, Hitchens was just starting to come around. The Iraq War was really big. So, you know, I started to question my Christianity and stuff. But that was the beginning, as you say, of my religious journey. And I love it. You know, if I raise kids nowadays, I'll probably, if I had to choose a tradition, it would be that Christian tradition. I loved my upbringing. You know, a lot of questionable things. But if I had to pick a religion, you know, I definitely would be Christianity. So I really appreciate that upbringing. I thank my mom for it a lot nowadays. I used to almost borderline hater for it, but I really appreciate. Yeah, you know, I had a real falling out with my mom, you know, with all the various religions. But these days, I really thank her for how she raised me, especially in that Christian tradition, because there's a lot of good stuff there. And I think it really is back on the rise now. If you look at the stats, people talk about Islam rising. There is this traditional Christian uprising in America now. It's coming back, that faith and values thing. It's very attractive, a positive message. And I had a very positive Christian upbringing, you know, and it was nice. And I get to talk about that a lot. But a shout out to Milton Congregational Church, you know, it's a little old school church built in 1726. That's where I went to my Sunday school classes and got my little, you know, indoctrination. All these religions have built in indoctrination, and they're nice teachers that show up. So it's cool to see how a lot of these religions use these systems. But that's where
So then when you converted to Islam, you said you had, did your family have a problem with that? It seems like there was a bit of a, did your mom, you said, had you had a bit of a fallout with it because of Islam, converting to Islam?
Yeah, I think anybody involved in religious conversion is going to, you know, empathize with the situation of having to deal with, you know, your parents, because that's always a difficult decision throughout history. It's really tough. I mean, there were several falling outs with my parents. The first one, obviously, when I left Christianity, kind of as I went to college. You know, anybody that grows up in a strict religious household, when they have that freedom and they're open to new ideas, they usually rebel. And I had a little bit of that rebellious period. And I don't want, you know, people to really, you know, blame that from, you know, conversion. And I also did a lot of the necessary research about the history of the church and the history of the scriptures. And, you know, many of those things, you know, led me to Islam as well. You know, so I researched a lot. And when I did leave Christianity, that was like the first falling out with my mother. You could imagine that. She grew up as a Christian, our whole family. And that was really tough. We didn't talk for a while. And then obviously when, you know, a couple years later, when I ended up getting into Islam for various reasons, that was an initial falling out. But I was able to use those good Islamic talking points and those smooth lines to smooth her over, and she ended up kind of accepting it. And we had this really cool positive relationship when I was a Muslim and she was a Christian, because I was able to use a lot of those YouTube guys and their one-liners against my mom, and like, oh, Islam is the religion of the prophets and it's all the same religion. I used to use these lines. She was like, oh, it's okay. So we had a much major, more falling out when I left Christianity versus when I became Muslim.
Okay.
When I became Muslim, I was able to really smooth it out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Islam does have a lot of these talking points you could use to kind of draw Christians in. And they were used on me, and I used them well. And
The interesting, the data shows, Pew polls show that the biggest out group is Christians becoming Muslim. The biggest in-group into Islam is Christians, and the biggest out-group is atheists. So Christians tend to convert more to Islam than to just become atheists, and at least based on the poll that I saw, which was quite interesting, quite fascinating. Like you said, there's a lot of talking points, as you put it, that appeal. And even my wife, for example, she converted from Christianity, Protestantism, or Pentecost to Islam. So there is definitely some commonalities that appeal to Christians. And I think the biggest group of Christians that leave Christianity end up as Muslim.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's several reasons. And, you know, I'm kind of a sarcastic person. So people watching this, you know, you'll have to catch that. You know, I kind of mockingly talk about talking points. But there are very legitimate intellectual, logical, historical arguments that are made that are very convincing to Christians. Because from a Christian perspective, there are basically three problems I have with Christianity. And a lot of Christians have. One is the divinity of Jesus, like Jesus being God.
Yeah.
Two is the Trinity, having a triune God. And number three is the history of the Bible, how the Bible was put together. Those are three questions that we always ask our priests and our pastors growing up, and there's no good answers.
Yeah.
You cannot explain the Trinity, Jesus being God, the history of the Bible being changed. These are tough issues. And me growing up in this Iraq War era and Bart Ehrman books being published and Dawkins coming out, these were questions that were constantly being berated, and there's no answers. And Islam comes around with this. Quran has been preserved since the beginning. Jesus Jesus is just a prophet, one God, simple. This is the culmination of the faith. It has kind of a logical pull. And when I read the English translation of the Quran, you know, I'm not a cult follower. You know, I like to think like I'm a normal person. You know, I have a decent living. I have a normal brain. I have a degree. I'm not a brainwashed. I didn't get brainwashed, but I read these arguments and say, you know, some of this really makes sense. But then once you get convinced, you have to use that same logic at the counter arguments. There are counter arguments there. Yeah. But I think that's one of the reasons why you get drawn in, because there's a lot of problems with Christianity that Islam claims to solve. Yeah. And Muhammad used the same things from the beginning.
Yeah.
That
makes sense.
And again, that's my perspective. You know, other converts may have other reasons. And maybe they got in a relationship with a handsome Muslim male. Maybe they,
you know, that happens a lot.
But this is just my perspective. And, you know, the whole podcast is in my perspective, my opinion. So,
yes, exactly. Yeah. That's a disclaimer, folks. This is only his opinion. But then, of course, everyone has an opinion, right? So we're here to explore the journey and to go to the thinking process and what. And this is actually a good point. You're making a very good point that Islam has these, I like the word talking points. I'm going to keep using that, has these talking points that work well. Because on the surface level, it is more consistent, right? Like it's more appealing intellectually to say that there's only one God, even though, I mean, Trinity is supposed to be one God too, but like, you know, it's actually three in one or whatever. And the whole thing about Jesus being a man. But then, of course, once you get into Islam, then there's a whole lot of like incoherencies that start to appear as you are in the religion, which I didn't notice as well as a Muslim. But as time went by, I started to have little kind of small doubts. So what happened with you then? How did what caused you to start investigating even that Islam was not? So let's talk about you as a Muslim first, actually, before we talk about you leaving Islam. So tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is
Muslim John. Did you change your name?
I changed it to Yahya, which you did. Is Arabic. Well, I had my name changed for me, basically. I mean, there's my journey in Islam. I mean, I don't want to really bash it. I do almost miss it in some ways, yearn for it. I appreciate it. I do very much love, I mentioned I come from the Sufi form of Islam. I do very much love the deeper, beautiful spiritual Islam that is there. I left for various reasons, and we'll get into that. But as a Muslim, I converted during a time where a lot of terror attacks were happening. And that is one very interesting statistics, is that when a 9/11 or when there are attacks happening, converts go up, white people convert. And that's, I kind of equate it to kind of maybe joining the dark side or, but that's a weird thing. So I was kind of from that irk, and I ended up just joining the local mosque, which happened to be a very heavy Pakistani, Desi, Sufi, Hanafi form of Islam. And that's just kind of what I got drawn into. Uh-huh. And the Imam was one of these very gentle, peaceful Sufi characters. We would sit and eat biryani and eat, you know, delicious food. I gained 50 pounds when I was a Muslim, by the way. So we would eat food and discuss these deep issues. And he gave me, quote unquote, answers that my pastors were never able to give me when I was a kid. Yeah. We would do the early morning Fajr prayer. And if you're a guy, Islam is good because it's just great. You got a bro, you know, hey, let's hang out with the guys. Let's eat and party. And then the women, when you're a guy, it's awesome. So I'm hanging out with these guys and we're talking about the meaning of life. And we're talking about, you know, the one God. And we're talking about the history of the Quran. And he would talk to me about Uthman and Umar, and these, he'd have all these quick answers, and he would seem so scholarly, and he would name off these verses, and you have the whole Quran memorized. So as an academic person and as a seeker of truth, that was very impressive to me. They're like, oh my God, there's people all over the world that are memorizing this book. There's all these huge, you know, bookshelves with these beautiful, you know how they do the Arabic words in different books. There's this huge, this kind of scholarly tradition. And I knew about the golden age and things like this. So to find the quote unquote dark aspects of Islam, it actually is kind of hard to learn about the age of Aisha and, you know,
what do you mean it's kind of hard? Like, what do you mean by that?
It seems, at the time I was in Islam, you have these giants like Hamza Yusuf and Menk and your local imam, and you have these constant built-in talking points. It's hard to do the research.
Do you mean, in my perspective. Do they cover up these issues, you mean? Or like they obfuscate them? Or are you saying they're not, the information is not available easily? Or is it that people get angry at you or like try to put you down? Or what do you mean?
I just think they have really good answers.
People that
do question.
Apologetics, basically.
Yeah, there's really good apologetics in Islam. Yeah. And that's something. And to me, Christianity was really weak at that. So I appreciated the almost academic nature of, hey, why do I have to wipe my ass with my hand? What the hell is this? Or why do I have to lick my fingers when I'm eating food? Yeah. Oh, because the saliva in your fingers helps digestion. Hey, that sounds pretty good. You know, why do I have to sleep on my, this side? Oh, because it's better for your heart. I mean, they have these kind of strange, and when you leave Islam, you're like, oh my God, I believe these things. But when you're in there, you're hanging out with the boys and you're eating biryani and you're, you know, off the drugs and stuff, it has this built-in thing. And that's what I mean, that all these religions have an inner positivity and an inner beauty. But what drew me away from Christianity is really also what drew me away from Islam, is I did start to research the history of the Quran and how it was put together. And when I converted, a lot of this stuff wasn't out. Your channel wasn't out.
Oh, yeah.
Apologetics were, and once I saw a lot of these videos, I said, wow, the Quran has not been preserved. And that's been what Muslims have been told forever. So that changed me a lot. And also the people inside the mosque and a lot of the people issues were similar between Christianity and Islam. That, you know, the religions are great, but the people, they're doing a lot of these shady things. And I don't want to talk about that too much.
Yeah.
And also, I started to really get disenfranchised with the doctrine. Like, Christianity has the deity of Christ as a big issue, the Trinity's issue. Islam has a lot of issues as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You
know, very questionable doctrines. And we could talk specifically, but I really started to sit back and think, why am I staying up so late during Ramadan when I got to work the next morning? Like, why am I, not able to eat food with my friends? Like, why are people giving me, I'm making good money writing music, for TV shows and stuff. And why is my mom telling me to go work at a factory and give up music? Like why, why? And that was the big thing for me.
Oh, my God.
This was even in this kind of Sufi sect. I was in this Sufi sect.
Yeah, where we were, which is somewhat progressive.
Progressive.
Kind of, right?
We did have music.
Yeah.
We did go to kind of these Qawwalis and these, big 3-hour programs, But there was always this inherent, anti-music nature. And for me, that was kind of the last nail in the coffin, that my music career started to really get hot. And a lot of these issues, I ended up leaving Islam, and it's been a very private issue basically until now. So I thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. I don't want to seem negative. There are some really strong criticisms I have, but I'm trying to really stay positive. But because I think that's what your channel does well. When I was deep within the faith, it was all about Shabir Ali versus whoever, or Mufti Meng versus whoever, Zakir Naik versus whoever. And I used to love those guys, and we used to sit and watch those debates and be like, yeah, Shabir Ali got him again. And Ahmed Didat, he was my guy. I was buying those Ahmed Didat tapes. I was ordering them from South Africa. And like I love that. And when you watch them, it seems like the Christians getting owned every time. So, I love that these days your channel and other channels have a little different vibe to them. It's not really about gotchas. It's more about these kind of more positives. I do have a lot of negatives, but I have been trying to be pretty positive so far. Thank you for giving me the chance to talk about
no
it.
This problem.
Is the first time. It's been a couple years since I de-reverted. And, I'm doing fine.
I was going to say, it's interesting about the whole like academic thing with Islam, because now the way, when I reflect on it now, the way I see it, it's actually unacademic, because you have this huge emphasis on memorizing, which made sense 1400 years ago. The imam has to be the one that knows the most Quran, and you have to memorize, because you want to preserve it, and hardly anyone can read and write at that time, right? if you put it from Muhammad's perspective, you have an illiterate society, and so you want to keep this thing alive. So what do? You give a reward to people that memorize. And so you have, you know, in these modern institutions today, in Medina, for example, where you're memorizing Bukhari, like you memorize the entire freaking book, which to me is such a huge waste of energy. Because if you compare it to like a modern, for example, professor, lawyers don't memorize law books. They know the case studies, they know the examples, they're able to look up and apply the knowledge. They have the understanding of the rules of law, but they don't memorize the entire subject body matter, right? And so now what you have is you have videos where they have, you know, competitions where someone is like, okay, read this surah and this. I understand the Quran is a little bit exceptional in that sense, but like even other books are memorized too, where the guy's like asking a little kid, read this hadith, and the guy memorized the whole entire hadith with the chain, which is so redundant. Because within the age now of information technology, we have everything, you know, preserved electronically. There's no need for that. It's honestly stupid. You're wasting all of these little children's lives, especially kids. They're sitting there hour after hour reading, and we're talking about like years of their life, like literally 1 to 2 years of their life. They're taken out of school.
Oh, it can be more than that, brother. Yeah. I have a very interesting, sorry to interrupt you. I have a very interesting perspective on this, because my background besides music is I was actually a public school teacher as well. So I have a passion for academia.
Oh, okay.
And when I was in Islam, I saw this to a very extreme level, and that started to really shock me. Is at first I was very impressed at those ability, the memorization. But you know, part of being kind of the white guy in the mosque is you get attached to certain families, and I got attached to this one family. And they had this one son, this beautiful, bright young kid, and they just, it seems like right from the womb, they wanted to turn him into a Hafiz. So they sent him to this crappy school in New York. And sorry, I say it in the Pakistani accent because that's where I come from, a Hafiz. So, you know, and they sent him to this crappy Quran school from like age 8, where this poor young man is sitting there sleeping on the carpet with these old imams, and all he's learning is one book all day, memorizing. And they're somehow beating the public school laws, and they're somehow, you know, they clean the place up during inspection time. And there's hundreds of these Bangladeshi boys and these second generation immigrants, their parents want a Hafiz. They grow their first beard. They have these ugly mangy beards. They walk around New York with these long jubas. And now I'm going to be negative because they're destroying these young kids' lives. And this kid now is like 16. He hasn't memorized the Quran yet because he's a modern kid. He has self. Yeah. It just hasn't worked. But he's got rich Muslim immigrant parents full of gas stations and companies. And, you know, they're very wealthy, very strong immigrants. So they're funding this kid. He hasn't read Shakespeare. He hasn't written an essay, a 5-paragraph essay in his life. He doesn't know taxes. He doesn't know anything. And when I started making my first trips to the Arab world and the Pakistani world and in my local mosque, just the level of overall stupidity and lack of intelligence and thick-headedness started to get at me. At first, I was impressed at the quote-unquote academia, but there are just, and forgive my sarcasm, this is my opinion, there are not a lot of smart, in general, Muslims. And when I say smart, I mean enlightenment smart, in terms of that Shakespeare, Robespierre, John Locke, these values, writing essays, being able to debate, being able to look at science. And these are just basic things we learn from kindergarten through fifth grade in the American public school system that I watched this poor young kid who now still doesn't have the Quran memorized.
Yeah.
He's got delusions of being sent to Egypt and to one of these schools. And that is going on all over, not just the Islamic world, all over America. There are these shady little Islamic institutes.
Madrasas,
with one bathroom, 30 kids, and they're just sitting there learning the Quran.
Yeah, and a lot of them...
in this place in Chicago, the head of the school got caught, you know, fondling the secretary. Yeah. So there's all these issues that pop up. And to me,
and
this is where the organized religion starts to infect the quote unquote the beauty of the religion itself.
Yeah.
So these are criticisms you have with Christianity, with the priests and the nuns and things like that. You have criticisms with Islam. But what you're mentioning, I've seen firsthand. It's very shocking. And if listeners have never seen that, you should really be aware that there are thousands of bright young minds that are only learning one book. And Bill Maher's been saying that for 20 years. There are schools that these kids only memorize one book. And I didn't actually know they were memorizing Hadith. I didn't know that they're forcing people to memorize Bukhari.
Yeah, I don't know if necessarily kids would do that in not in America for sure, but like, say for example, in the Middle East or like in, especially adults would definitely be memorizing Hadith books, right? Ones that are studying in Medina or whatever. If you're in the school of Hadith, faculty of Hadith, you're memorizing Hadith, which is, I don't know. I think it's such a waste of effort.
But then on the flip side, you have a Hamza Yusuf.
Hamza Yusuf's a good counter.
Who not only memorizes and studies these Arabic tradition, he also seems to have this...
He has a Western intellectual background. He studied the Great Gatsby, like the classics of our civilization. Like, I bet you probably read the Great Gatsby.
Of course, these great works I mentioned.
Lord of the Flies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hamlet.
Lord of the Flies in 10th grade.
Yeah,
Hamlet
exactly.
In 9th grade, yeah. And I remember what grade I studied them because we dug deep in those damn books.
Yes, and so did I. And this built, you know, a sort of foundation. And not everyone goes into literature. I mean, I didn't. I went into, like, tech and you went into music, but it's there. And I think
are basic studies throughout Western history from the Greek BC areas. The idea of studying great literature and studying music and studying science, these are developmental. And as a teacher, this is these are developmental things that are important for the basic human to learn. Mm. And a lot of it does not happen in the Arab world. So one of the great charities that I donate to these days, even post-Islam, and there's many you could look up. I don't want to name single ones because I don't like doing that. But one of the big efforts right now is to translate these great works into Arabic.
Oh, yeah.
Export them to the Arab world. This is a huge effort that's happening right now. There's UN funding going around. You could just sit on Google for a while. One of the big efforts is to, it's time to stop demonizing the, you know, ISIS is basically quote unquote done. And we're ready to finally turn this chapter and reach the Arab world in a non-combative way. And one of the major ways is to translate these great works that we've mentioned into Arabic and export these Enlightenment Western ideas to the Arab world. If they don't know what John Locke's idea of freedom of property is, then we can't expect them to come to this 21st century. So this is one of the great charities I recommend people will look into, is to translating great works into Arabic. There's a lot going on.
One of my friends, his name is Faisal Said Al-Mutta. He has a organization as well called Ideas Beyond Borders. And they've actually got like some funding as well. And they've translated Dawkins' books. And they're also translating a bunch of Wikipedia articles that are available in English into Arabic. So that's I support his project as well.
And on the flip side, all of our English listeners, we should also try to seek out the great Arabic classics, because that's one thing I discovered in the Sufi tradition that a lot of these Salafis don't get.
Oh, yeah.
Why? There's beautiful books of musical theory and celestial theory and theory of a diet. And there's many just great Arabic classic works that we don't learn about. And there's Hindu works, and there's great, Mongol works. There's, you could look up Amir Khusro, and there are great Indian empires that we don't learn about in school. So we should also, as Westerners, you know, look up these great Arabic works. Mm-hmm. And that's where, at one time, there was like a 100-year period where Christians and Muslims did that, and it worked out really well. And there was this peaceful period in the world where there was this connection, but it didn't happen. But we can make that happen through the exchange of great ideas. There are great Arabic poets and great Urdu ideas and poets out there as well. We should study a little bit of that as well. Imagine that in universities.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. It probably does happen, I'd say, a little bit less at the...
It's happening more now, I think.
Maybe more at the university and college level, but that would be like a kind of opt-in, right? It wouldn't be general. I think we also need to teach financial literacy. I think that's another thing that's missing. And that's
how about
a big
those
help.
Islamic loans.
Oh yeah, we could talk about that too. One thing I thought that was quite. Another thing I find quite disheartening and sad is this whole thing about people telling you to quit your job. Like, I have a friend who's a Pakistani friend, and he is a very qualified, he's a systems analyst, and he works in finance. And then, of course, he became religious, sort of like converted, you can say, like, even though he's born Muslim but wasn't practicing. And now he has this massive guilt. Right, he's like, I'm working in finance, I hate it. And he's like, I can do this other job, but it pays me like so little. And he actually did it for a while, right? But he couldn't survive on the income that he was getting from this other, I don't even remember what it was. I don't think it was deliveries, anything that low, but it was way below his skill set. And he keeps getting jobs in finance paying really well because he knows it and he's good at it, right? And he lives with this massive guilt. Did you live with any guilt because of the music thing?
Oh, like, yeah.
Telling you that, oh, you shouldn't be doing this, and
yeah,
your income is haram, your food is haram. Like, were people telling you this? And
yeah, I went through many phases, and one of my, I remember the initial days of my conversion, my first day, my second day, my first Juma, and one of the first quote-unquote teachings I got when I sat with that nice imam was the idea of halal versus haram, food. They'd start with food. He's like, hey, brother, what are you eating? Oh, this and that. But then they kind of disguise it as healthy. Oh, hey, our meat is very healthy. You know, we slaughter the animal in a humane, you know, this is the Jewish idea. You know, we should start talking about eating halal. Oh, okay. And then the next question was, what do you do for a living? I said, this music. And then the idea of, well, we have to make sure our income sources are halal. You know, we have to make sure our money, the people that run our gas stations shouldn't sell alcohol. And that was a big thing. One of our local mosque members was selling alcohol. So the money isn't haram, and was donating to the mosque. So these ideas of halal versus haram kept in. And naturally, through my process, I experienced that guilt, you know, being a moderately, at the time I converted, I was basically a moderately successful musician. I was still working day jobs as well, like part-time on the side to sustain myself. I wasn't extremely successful.
Yeah.
When I started to get a little bit more successful with my music, I started to develop little arguments in my head to justify music in Islam. And that's when I really got into Sufism and the Qawwalis and traveling to Pakistan and learning tabla and harmonia. Oh, many times. Yeah. I got really into this thing, man. I mean, my mosque was like, it's 100% Pakistani mosque. That is a very big thing. You know, if you're an American Muslim, you probably got two mosques in town. You got the Pakistani mosque and the everyone else mosque. I mean, it's a huge, I mean, yeah, this is a kind of stereotype. But no, I was involved with that Pakistani tradition, which is very musical. You go to a Pakistani Islamic wedding, they're going to do the Bhangra. So I kind of developed these justifications. So that was a phase where I became a stronger Muslim. But I did experience that guilt. And in any religion, you could develop these arguments. You know, it's like being a gay Christian. You know, there's a time when you're in the closet and you feel bad. And these days, being a gay Christian is like a thing. It's like, cool. Yeah. So you can take it both ways. But I used to hang out with like the Salafi types in the kind of very beginning before I was deciding which mosque to go to. And they were all about the haram stuff. Yeah. And that kind of planted the seed of, hey, at least, and this is a big problem with Islam.
Yeah.
It's like, at least this doctrine exists. At least there are people that do believe this. So that means there really is a problem with the book.
Yeah.
There is a problem here. Like, even though these guys are cool with music, there are still the mosque a couple towns over that believe this is haram and believe this is, that means there really maybe are some issues. And then you learn about, oh, there's 20 hadith books, there's not 8. And then you learn about, oh, there's Shiism, oh, there's this, and that's when you start questioning and things like that. So once I found that divergence of opinion that, hey, Islam isn't this one true perfect religion, there are divergent opinions, huh?
Yeah, and I think
it's kind of weird.
I think even more so because you're a convert. If you're just Desi and you're just born and you're just Hanafi and you just pray the Hanafi way and you just eat the Hanafi, like if you're basically in that, you don't see that as a problem.
Hands on the stomach, brother. If not, get out of the mosque. Do not pray like this in the Desi mosque. No way. Get out. Get your ankle off my ankle. Get out of here. Get out of here, you Arab. I mean, they have these ideas, you know.
Yeah. And you notice it more because you're from outside that tradition. When you come in, you're like seeing the differences. Whereas someone that's already in it, they're kind of like, yeah, whatever. This is what I am. And
they that's don't... why I started with that Christian upbringing. I am so thankful to my mom now that I had a Christian upbringing versus seeing how 100%, not 99, seeing how 100% of these Muslims in my local mosque, at least, are raising their kids. I am so thankful I had a Christian upbringing. I mean, seriously.
It's like night and day.
Seriously, it's like night and day. And there's a reason why all these third generation Muslims are all deconverting. They're all going to college and
drinking. Like, what do you mean? Like, can you be more specific? What did your mom do that the Muslims didn't do that you saw?
Yeah, and all these stereotypes I'm listing off, I could be very specific. So the way Muslim kids are raised, the way the religion is designed, there is a lot of Jew hatred. There's a lot of Christian hatred. There's a lot of otherism. There's a lot of anti-Americanism, at least in this time that I was involved in America. There was a lot of this taqiyya idea of, hey, you know, you could be friends with the kids in school, but no. You're not going to go. There was a lot of kind of living in the mosque. And, we were very dedicated Sufis. There was a lot of, we had our own doctor's clinic right next door to the mosque. We had a restaurant right next door to the mosque. There's this otherism is the big deciding, kind of dressing out, their dad's wearing their traditional Pakistani hat, which is fine. You have the right. But a lot of these things, create in a child something that the modern Westerner Christian doesn't. We have a very big belief in the way we're raised in diversity and inclusion. The overall Christian message, we have those colorful books of Jonah and the whale, the coloring books. The Sunday school curriculum is very structured. But what these Muslim kids are learning, they're sitting and just memorizing, ba, pa, tha, no, beta, tha, tha, take your tongue and tha, tha, ah, tha, what the hell? No, but when I was a young Christian, I'm learning stories about Noah's Ark, and there's pretty pictures, and I had the pretty hot Sunday school teacher. Pretty. So, so for me, the message of Christianity is much more positive.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus was this cool hippie. Yeah. And when you're raised in this Islamic household, your uncles are over, they're coming over with that serious Muslim face, and they're arguing about the mosque, and they're talking about these Americans and this. There is a, not religion, there is a culture that I noticed, at least in my local mosque, and many listeners are probably laughing their ass off right now because they know these stereotypes are true. This is happening everywhere, and there are, and you've interviewed a lot of them, several Muslims that are raised exactly how I'm telling you, and a lot of these Muslims go to mosque every day after school. In my local mosque, there's an everyday class, and it's a Pakistani mosque, so they're always arguing about raising the fee versus lowering the fee. So it's like $100 a month. You get basically an extra 2 hours of babysitting.
Yeah.
The imam takes 30 kids. They line them up with those little wooden shelves with a colorless book, and they learn to hate Islam, but they're forced to do it. There's not a culture of kind of rebellion in those. It's a very systematic structure in a Western society. There's rebels. We have 80s music. We don't need no education. This has been part of Westerners, we've developed the raising of the kid. The kid is very coddled, in Western culture. We do the sports and stuff like that, and there's a lot of the 100% of the kids I watched, they didn't have that appreciation for the Western society that they were living in. So there was always this overall us versus them, and the Jew hatred is also a big deal. And
anti-Semitism,
I like to say Jew hatred. I don't like to say anti-Semitism. I like to say Jew, because anti-Semitism is about is just very different. That it's just a bad term now. Once I say it, people won't listen. But there's a lot of Jew hatred. And then once they become teenagers, the girls start, making the decision to maybe wear the veil in school. Or
well, they don't really make the decision. The decision is made for them, usually.
Well, yeah, at least in my kind of the mosque I was at, the Pakistan, it's very part of it. And when they go to mosque, they all wear their pretty, dresses and stuff. But they start covering up and stuff, and they start being. And when you're secluded from age three from boys and girls. And you notice these things. These are developmental things. That
and it doesn't happen in the Christian community.
In the Christian, I was dating the girls in my youth group. I mean, the only reason I went to Sunday school when I was 14 is to talk to the girl and get her phone number.
Wow.
We used to go to these weekend conferences, these Christian conferences. We'd just be making out in the hotel rooms the whole time.
That wasn't sanctioned by the...
No, sex before marriage is known in the Christian tradition as being a doctrine that is there, but your parents and everyone knows that everyone does it. Education is very big in Christian households. It's very big in the pub. We talk about it. You know, my grandpa basically talked to me about, you know, how to deal with a girl and stuff. So these are things that happen. And in Islam, 99% of these kids, the first time they're going to be with a person is on the night. Which, all right, you know, I think 75% of the world does it that way. Yeah. So, you know, it is what it, but... developmentally, that's not the way to do it.
Yeah, I've heard some ex-Muslim girls talking about this, how confusing it is that the first time they, you know, they're introduced to sex is that the parents are telling them, we're going to get you married. And it's like, all this years, you told me, you didn't let me talk about boys, and now all of a sudden, you're telling me I'm going to get married. And it's like, it's a shock, right? Because you didn't prepare for that. You didn't lead up to it. It's just like, no, don't talk to boys. You know, if you talk to boys, you'll get in trouble, and you'll get slapped even sometimes. Like, this one ex-Muslim girl by the name of Zaira Zaleen. She has an article called, you know, about how she was forced to marry her cousin, and that's what caused her to eventually leave the home and eventually leave Islam. But it was this strange dichotomy that if she was even seen talking to a boy, she was like her father would have beat her, but then she's expected to sleep with this man that she doesn't even know, or her cousin. You know what I'm saying? It's just like from 0 to 100 in all at once.
And in many cases, they watch their older siblings go through it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these Muslim households, here's another big difference, is they have a lot of kids.
Yeah.
And a lot of Christian households, there's a lot of, you know, one kid. I was the only child. That's a big thing in Christian cultures all over the world.
I thought Christians also have big families too.
Not in the U.S. sometimes. Okay. Not in the U.S. Yeah. And India, that's one of the big talking points about the population control, is they say, you know, the Christian portions of India have less kids. There's a lot of racism going on in India right now. These Muslims have too many kids. Christians, we only have one. So that, you know, I'm talking stereotypes, but definitely, you know, numbers wise in the U.S., Christian households have less kids. You know, less kids. There's a lot of only childs, things like that. So when a lot of these Islamic families I was hanging out with, when you notice your older siblings going through the wedding and the beautiful wedding and the cousin, like, it becomes normalized. And it's normalized to make fun of, hey, this rich Jew. And, you know, it's normalized to, hey, this fucking American, you know, their dad's talking about that fucking Bush again, you know, Osama had good ideas, you know, if Saddam was in power, this would be good. But when you're hearing your siblings and stuff talk about this stuff, you know, this is a thing. And they're very big families, which have a lot of pros, also has a lot of cons. And there's these, each family, and this is one thing I loved about Islam, I love the big families, I love the family values. It's like each family is their own unit. Mm-hmm. Like, you have enough people, like, they eat together, the siblings sit and eat out of the same plate. Like, and so this is really cool, but they see their siblings go through these same things. So developmentally, there's a huge difference versus how I grew up with my own bedroom, you know, eating, you know, in the living room with the TV on, you know, versus, you know, eating, you know, together and things like that. There are pros and cons to the Islamic family system versus the Christian family system. I'm in no position to say which one is quote unquote right. I'm just in a very interesting perspective to have seen both of them firsthand and have believed in both of them and have, you know, almost in many ways thinking the Islamic model was better at one point. Yeah. But now, like I say, I'm very thankful for the Christian upbringing I had, especially doctrinally and morally. I think I treat women, you know, I was taught to treat and respect women much more. I think Christians generally, you know, at least religiously and doctrinally, are taught to appreciate and respect women much more, because many of Christians will have a women pastor or woman priest up there talking to them. So there's a more tolerance, I think, in my opinion, again, my opinion, in Christianity than what you'll develop through a life of Islam.
Yeah, I want to say something about that because maybe was it last year? I went to Easter Passover thing at the church, and my wife said, "Let's just go and see it." So we went, and it was kind of eye-opening for me because it was so different from what you'd see in the mosque, and like the women were engaged and involved, and that's what actually stood out to me—the whole thing about how the women were involved in the service. Because in the mosque, they're not involved in the service. They're out of sight, out of mind. I mean, sometimes there's a barrier, sometimes it isn't.
Wait, typically, brother, they are involved in the meal afterwards.
In the Pakistani mosque, they're involved in the cooking. But you ever, this is kind of a digression, but did you ever go for a tabligh jamaat?
Yeah, well, the kind of crew that I used to hang out with, there was always a few guys that did that, and they would always come in and say, "Hey, Yahya, come, let's do that." But then the other crew I was hanging out with would be like, no, don't hang out with those guys. They're not. So we would always hang out, and the Sufis were always, the Sufi mosque, everybody could come in and kind of make fun of each other. "Hey, look at this guy." So, you know, there'd always be those tablighi guys coming around. "Hey, let's go do some of that. But I never did it because my kind of close friends would be like, no, Allah will decide what they're doing is nothing.
They were saying it's bid'ah, or it's not actually part of Islam. Is that what they were saying?
Well, basically our mosque, and something I was really impressed with about our imam, is we had this idea of we really don't want to wear our Islamic clothes in public. We want to blend in with the society.
Okay.
So our imam would always have, you know, nice hair, a nice polo when we would go out and bowl or hang out and stuff like that. So we always had that idea of, you know, let's blend in and be a peaceful part of society. That's, I love the Sufism, but, you know, those tablighi guys would always like us to come and, you know, wear the stuff and go be a little more hardcore, but I never participated in it. But the crews are all around. In my area, there's a lot of kind of little mosques, and there's very strong ethnic Muslim communities, so we would always see these guys, and you know, everybody's kind of pokes fun of each other. And that's a big problem with Islam. You know, you're supposed to have this one true, pure, perfect religion, all these books, and they can't figure all this stuff out. I mean, it's a quip, but it actually is a major problem.
And my wife had problems with that too when she converted to Islam. She was like, "Everybody's saying something different. Like, what am I supposed to do?" And me too, to a lesser extent. I ended up kind of selecting the Salafi path for myself. So I got to that phase, but Salafism is another can of worms in itself. I think it's much worse. I mean, I think you're much better off being in the
Pakistani. I had white Islamic brother friends that I'm lucky. It's like being born in one state versus the other. I would see converts that unfortunately were living in the town with the Salafi mosque, and they would end up changing their Facebook.
Oh my God!
I would see this kind of, and we would go to these white Muslim gatherings, and you could always see the ones that ended up hanging out with the Salafi guys, and you know, not to mock or anything, but, you know, but you would always notice, and that's kind of the stereotypical Muslim white convert, is that Salafi type. I'm definitely a rarity.
Yeah.
But my mosque loved having me, the token white guy. Every mosque loves having a token white guy. And, you know, they use that and kind of abuse that out of me too, you know, as well. So, but you see a lot of, you know, I think the Salafism, I guess, with a lot of what you're doing, a lot of stuff, I think it is going down. It's almost like, it's like a talking point now. Oh, that's just Salafi Wahhabi. That's like a get out of jail free card now. Back when I was a really involved Muslim, that wasn't really a thing. Like, you couldn't just make fun of Wahhabis like that.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that. But now, in a lot of these YouTube videos, people are like, "Aha, that's Salafi Wahhabi." And they don't have to answer the question. I'm like, no. I don't think it's at the level of joking around yet.
Yeah.
It still is a strong ideology. It is very attractive to a lot of white
comments. It's well funded too. And it has,
I'm glad, like you said, I didn't end up like that.
I've seen them. It's such a difference. Like, these guys end up taking these like Arabic names. I'm Al Amrika, you did take Yahya, which is actually the Arabic name John, but these guys will like go even further. They'll call themselves the American. Some of them even end up in like terrorist groups, right? So, I mean, that's the worst it can get to. So, even though Salafism itself is not, doesn't approve of that, it's so close to what, you know, ISIS is following that it's just a stone's throw away, you know, to go from that step. And then the whole hatred, you know, Salafism has a very strong, even more so than Sufism, with us, actually extremely more than Sufism, this us versus them thing, right? This, like, those are the kuffar and Dar al-Harb, and this is Dar al-Iman, and we don't want to support them in any ways. I had people at the mosque telling me, oh, I don't want to compost because that helps the kuffar. And I'm like, as a Muslim, I was shocked, and I was a Salafi Muslim. I was shocked that he said that because he lives in Canada, and he's saying, I don't want to help the kuffar. Dude, you're freaking dependent on them for everything. You live here.
and brother, I mentioned that concept earlier where it's like, I know these ideas are ridiculous, but the fact that they do exist and the fact that people can pull verses and hadiths to support them is a problem in itself. No matter how many Mufti Menk videos you could say to argue out of it, there are still these groups that can develop these verses. Same thing in Christianity. There's still these crazy Christian sects. There's a lot of them. There's a whole lot of them. I mean, when I was around, the Irish army was like a big issue. The Northern, that was a big issue and a big talking point. So the fact that you can interpret and there's radical Jews is a big issue. That's why, to me, and I keep coming back to this, that all these religions have a deeper purity that is there, but it's these textual interpretations that have been a problem. And I have a big problem with the text of the Bible and the text of the Quran and the text of the Hadith that leads to these interpretations. But deep down, I think there probably was a better Muhammad figure. There probably is a beautiful Islam in there. But these texts and these interpretations do exist. And that's a problem, no matter how many videos they say to answer them. The fact that these ideologies and these sects exist is a problem. You agree with that?
Yeah, I think at the end of the... I think that Islam is worse in this regard than some other religions, because if you look at what Muhammad did in his life, being this like state leader, this warrior, and the fact that he put jihad and martyrdom and the concept of, you know, huris and all of these things, because that actually helped the religion to grow like nothing else. However, the problem is it's become a plague in a society. And like, I wanted to ask you, you kind of talked about this a little bit. Like, was this sympathy? Did you find there was sympathy for like Osama bin Laden and stuff like that in the mosque, where people kind of like, oh, but he's a good guy? Because I used to hear this. I used to hear that, oh yeah, we don't really know bin Laden's a bad guy. He was actually a good guy. I actually heard this from Muslims. Not to say that, I think things might have changed now. I mean, this was 15 years ago. But like at the time, there were people sympathetic to them, and they're like, you don't really know, he's doing a good job, he's putting Americans in the place and this and that. And
no, these things still exist, brother. I mean, 15 years, I mean, these, you know, this is the time frame, you know, I'm talking about as well. But the thing is, these exist and they are rampant. The amount of conspiracy theories in the Islamic community, and especially the Arabic community, it's ridiculous. Mm. I mean, everything is the Jews. This small little country, everything is the Jews. Everything is Israel. Yeah. Everything is the U.S. I mean, the big thing is the 9/11 conspiracies. These young kids, they're all 9/11 truthers. I mean, these 9/11 conspiracies, that's the biggest one. They exist all over the place. Anti-Americanism. You go to your local mosques, I'm telling you, it is rampant. And once in a while, maybe a one sentence line in a Friday khutbah will end up there. They're not recording these things. Yeah. It's everywhere. On the ground in the Muslim community, there's a lot of these conspiracy theories, a lot of things like that. It's a big issue. Now, that used to happen in Christianity as well. Back in the Bush days, like I mentioned, you had a lot of pastors going up there telling people to vote for Bush, saying gay marriage is a sin, abortion is a sin, stem cell research is a sin, all this stuff, you know, the evangelical, that was a big issue in Christianity as well. So, you know, these religions, like you say, Muhammad, when they're tied to the state, when they're tied to these ideas, is a big deal. And now in retrospect, when I compare Jesus to Muhammad, it's no contest. Jesus takes the cake every time. Not a Christian, but just historically and theologically and morally and impactfully, and what they've done for the world, like positively, come on, Jesus takes the cake. Christianity versus Islam, give me a freaking break.
Yeah, I personally believe we'll never actually know what the historical Muhammad, like who was the historical Muhammad, because the sources we have are already filtered by Muslims. And
I have to plug this channel, brother. There's a very small channel called Sneakers Corner. Sneakers Corner. They're specifically dedicated to early Muhammad documents, and they unearth things from the 600s I've never seen before. You might like to see them, and they're having a little trouble growing and stuff, but because it's one guy, and they're really doing a lot of historical research on the early sources of Muhammad. They throw out all the hadith because they come from 800-900. Yeah. They just had Jay Smith on the other day, and they go through. There are several documents from the 600s. There are documents from Spain. There are documents from all over the place, and they paint a very interesting biography of Muhammad, you know, conquering Jerusalem and being killed by in the battlefield, being eaten by dogs. There are these weird early documents, exactly. And when he goes through these videos, you might really like that, because when something I believe strongly in is when you get to the historical Muhammad and throw out a lot of these hadiths, I think you do, and we might disagree here, I think you do find a very pure, wholehearted figure, a very actually beautiful, merciful Muhammad. I think it is there. And if you look at some of these documents from the 600s, you might believe that. So check out Sneakers Corner. It's a new channel really dedicated to that.
Interesting. Yeah, I would. So I'm willing to consider the possibility that Muhammad was sincerely believing in what he said as true, until we get to the point of Zainab. I think the whole Zainab marriage, where he got his, you know, son-in-law divorced from Zainab, and he just marched, you know, he hinted to Zayd that he liked Zainab, he was interested in her, he was attracted to her, and then, you know, he marched into her house and said, "I'm your husband," and she's like, "What?" "Yeah, Allah married me to you." I mean, that's very troubling, because there was no actual marriage ceremony, there was nothing. It was just like he just waltzed into a house, and just shows you the amount of power he had, right, to basically get any woman he wanted. And some even Muslim scholars have it actually mentioned, I don't remember the reference now, that Muhammad could have had any woman he wanted, married or unmarried. So, I mean, that's kind of like the most extreme example, where it feels like he's... Now, it is possible, I think, that maybe he was projecting his needs onto this Allah figure. And me and Abdullah Gondal are going to do a live stream, hopefully. I don't know if we're going to get to it today or not, but like, we're going to do it soon. We're going to talk about some examples of Muhammad's, according to what we've seen from the hadith and the Quran, like what seems to be a mental illness, you know, a sort of schizophrenia, a sort of, and it's not that he was like a crazy, like lunatic, deranged person. He was a well-adapted individual. He was a leader. He was a warrior and all that. But he had, you know, mental tendencies, right? Like certain tendencies that maybe he heard things in his head. And I know people like that. I've actually met people in real life that told me they hear things, and they got drugs and they're better now. But otherwise, you know, like well-adapted. Like this one of my fellow coders at my office, he was doing well for himself. He has a six-figure salary. He's a normal guy, but he told me this story privately, that he was hearing voices and he has mental illness in his family. So I think we can... I'm not totally sure, and I don't think we'll ever know for sure what happened in Muhammad's head. All we can do is speculate, and we can say, well, he did this, and he did this, and he did this. So I don't think he was a good guy, but maybe he was just behaving based on his flawed brain. Maybe his brain was messed up, and he was just, maybe he really thought Allah was talking to him. And, you know, like really narcissistic individuals are able to project that, and they believe God is talking to them. And so when they say, "God told me to do this," they don't even realize that they're lying. That's why this so convincing, because they believe it themselves. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, it could be that, or it just could be, you know, a man with big ideas. I mean, that's the thing, is when you strip it down, because a lot of the sources you'll use are a lot of these 8th, 9th century.
Yeah.
When you strip it down to the basic theological message, it's a man who wanted to rescue his people from idolatry. It's the classic prophet story. So it is just big ideas. And one thing that really does fascinate me about all these major religions is the fact that they do still exist means a lot. That there were And to kind of dilute it to mental issues, it's an interesting discussion. I would really look forward to seeing it. I think there are all the cult leaders of our history, like Jim Jones, there are religions that have leaders with mental issues throughout history. They don't last. So I think Islam and Muhammad did bring some very big, very good positive ideas about the traditional Jewish ideas of not drinking, of staying away from pigs and nasty food that's bad for you, of having a pure diet, of being merciful to animals, of being merciful to Christians, of loving everybody, of worshiping the one God that created you and fearing him and really being and really respecting and taking some time out of the day to wake up and pray and get up at a normal time and go to bed. I think deep down there's a man there that brought a lot of great changes to this very specific society, and this very specific society that had methods of writing and a history of preserving that somehow our world today kind of worships. I mean, there's plenty of Eastern religions as well, but there's a reason why I think a lot of Muhammad's big ideas have survived. But a lot of the negative portrayals, you could use a lot of these early, later sources and stuff to get this brutal Muhammad. And that did disturb me when I was in the faith, because people use those hadiths, whether I believe them or not. The fact that there are major Islamic countries and groups that use these hadiths and there's schools about them means, hands, I can't do Islam. Now, maybe in 50 years, if we get over that, maybe I'll reconvert and we get to, we'll get to a Quranless, hadithless, just pure, basically Judaism. Judaism is what it is. Maybe I'll get back. But right now, no.
Well, there is a movement which is called Quranism, right?
Not even the Quran only, because that guy Khalil Andani that you had on before, this idea of the written Quran is kind of a tough starting point as well. That even Quran only is tough, because what is the written Quran? What is the Bible? What is the written thing? We have to get away from writing. I think that's another human innovation, that the big ideas are what matters. The idea of worshiping one God, the idea of staying away from alcohol, the idea of having one wife, the idea of, being humble and praying and fasting and giving to church. These are the big ideas that we can trace back throughout history and culture. To get to the minutiae of the text, it's very fun, but it's unfortunate that that's how all these religions are based. All these Christian religions are based on these verses, and Islam is based on these books and stuff, and it's tough. So for me, hands off of that. Big ideas are what I think matters.
So for me, I feel like what you're trying to get at with these big ideas is, I think that's what humanism is. I think this idea of respecting others and treating others the way you want to be treated, of, helping your neighbor and, taking care of animals, taking care of the environment. I think we can filter this out of the religious teachings and make it's almost like a religion. Humanism is a religion, you could say, right? Although there's no books, there's no worshiping of anything. I do disagree, respectfully disagree with you about Muhammad. I think even if you go to what we know of as earliest sources, which would be the Seerah, you would find the same stories in the Seerah, for example. And some of these stories, by the time they get to the Hadith, they've been sanitized. For example, the whole Zainab story, it's more troubling in the earlier collections, which is basically the Seerah, Ibn Ishaq. By the time you get to Bukhari, or the Satanic Verses is another example, where in the Seerah, it's like Muhammad appealed to the Meccans by allowing, by saying these things that Shaitan said, or you can worship the three great cranes, Lat, Uzza, and Manat. But by the time you get to Bukhari, it's like, oh, no, he never said that. They just bowed down because they were so amazed by the Quran or something like that. Right? And the same thing with the Zainab story. By the time it gets to Bukhari, it's like, oh, no, he wasn't lusting for Zainab. It was that they had a fight. She had a fight with her husband and, he wanted to marry Muhammad. So if we go back to what Islam brought or any religion brings, I think it's always going to be like you said, there's always going to be pros and cons. For example, when you said don't eat food, don't eat nasty food. I've always wondered about the whole pig thing. I don't think from modern research, eating pig is no less healthy than eating beef or chicken or fish or anything else. There's pros and cons. Some people say pork is the new white meat in the sense that it has some, in my opinion, I think all meat is actually, in a sense, not the best thing to eat. It has, it's high in protein and all that, but from an ethical perspective, we'd be better off not eating any animals. I think it'd be better for the environment, it'd be better for the health overall. You know, the vegan diet, I think, is morally superior, and it's better for the environment and all that. Nevertheless, I don't think that actually you can really prove that eating pigs is bad. Now, there's a theory, and I don't know if it's true, and I never studied this academically, that, you know, because of the worms in the meat, and if you don't cook it properly, the pig, you know, it's unhealthy. But I don't know about that. And then some people say pigs are nasty because they eat their own poop and stuff like that. Well, that's not true in a modern farm. They don't eat poop. They eat hazelnuts and whatever you feed them. Chickens eat their own poop too. And chickens are not haram, right? Like, chickens will literally eat the poop off the floor if they're in poop, right? So that's not really, but you do get to a good point, which is that this religion had the right characteristics for survival and for spreading. If you look at it as a meta, as an idea, as a meme, the religion meme has all the characteristics to self-reproduce and to spread. It has this idea of course, you know, jihad, which is a big thing, right? Like, if you fight for spreading the religion, you get all this reward. So it actually spreads itself to jihad. It spreads itself to the idea of martyrdom. And then, of course, it's packaged in this nice package of, like, good deeds and be a good person and all that. In terms of women's rights, this is something I was discussing with a friend yesterday. Did Islam improve women's rights? I think we could possibly argue that it did bring some good things. For example, do not bury your daughter alive. Now, I'm not sure if they actually did bury their daughters alive, but assuming they did, this is a good thing, right? It's the whole idea of zakat is a good thing. You know, give 2.5% of your accumulated wealth to charity is a good thing. Now, of course, it's a sort of tax on holding. It's like a holding tax. It's not an income tax. So some people, if you spend all your money, there's no zakat. You know what I mean? Like, if you blow all your money, you wouldn't pay no zakat because you don't have any money. You spent it all. So it's an idea. But at that time, it was a good idea, I think. And I think it was helpful. I think Islam actually took away a lot of women's rights. For example, I've read that in pre-Islamic Arabia, and what's his name? Reza Aslan mentioned this. So this is actually like an academic point. Back in pre-Islamic Arabia, a woman could turn around her tent in order to divorce. Now, of course, in Islam, women cannot divorce. They have to go to the judge, a qadi, and they have to appeal their marriage. They have to either cancel their marriage, right? They have to annul their marriage, or they have to basically, and in which case they have to give back the mahar, or they have to ask the husband to divorce me. So, you know, say talak to me. And the husband has complete and utter control over the relationship, right? So either she gives back the mahar, the gift, and she asks an imam, and imam could say no, right? The judge, the qadi could say no. So this is my problem. I feel like, and I think you agree in that sense, it does give so much power to the man. The inheritance is half of what a son would get. So if you have a son and daughter, like I have a daughter and I have some sons, the daughter would get more, half of what the son would get. And then they would say, well, in that case, you know, in that time, the boys had to take care of the girls. So it was still, it's still their responsibility, even though they get money, her share, half of her share, they're supposed to give it to her, which to me doesn't make any sense because, well, just give it to her then. Like, what if she has kids? Or what if she has needs? Why would she have to beg her brother to take care of her when she should just get half of the inheritance? If you have two kids, any normal, you know, good parent would give half and half to each of the kids. Why would he get double and she get half of what he gets? You know what I'm saying? Like, so I think that's the whole thing with religion. It's always going to be some pros and cons here and there, but the reason it survived is not because I think it's good. I think it survived because it has survival characteristics, just like a good virus. Although I don't believe that, I don't, there's a debate among academics whether religion is a virus or whether it's adaptive. And I don't take the virus idea. I take the adaptive idea. I think it has enough, like you said, it tells you not to drink alcohol. It encourages you to have lots of kids. These things cause the religion to spread naturally. It makes it adaptive. I know I did bring up the world virus thing, but I don't hold that view as strong as the world adaptive thing. So I agree with you. Religion does help you survive, and that's why it's spread. And that's why to this day, it's still spreading, especially to births, not necessarily to conversions, but especially to the high birth rates of Muslims. We're going to have like 2 billion Muslims in the world at some point based on estimates. And so, you know, that's, anyways, I think I ranted too much. Yeah, go ahead. You want to reply to that?
No, it's all right, brother. That was a good rant. There's so much there, but I'm trying to remember. The first thing is that you talked about, like the criticisms of Muhammad and stuff.
Yeah.
It's always important, and I keep coming back to the big ideas to these religions, is you separate the man from the ideas. You know, Okay. Every man has these issues and has these things, and the modern equivalent is obviously Donald Trump. This man is full of flaws, right?
Yeah.
In terms of certain policies, there are actually some very strong positives, and from my perspective, things are pretty good. But the man is very flawed. Same thing with Muhammad. A lot of these criticisms, you're going to have these flaws. But these big ideas with these religions, I really do think do matter. But there is these built-in mechanisms, and Islam, I think, is the best of them. I've been through both of them. I've been through the Sunday school kind of tradition as a kid, going to youth group, kind of maybe thinking about going to Christian college. I've been through that perspective as a Christian. I've been through the Islamic route. Islam has built in quote unquote answers. You even brought up a couple talking points yourself in your rant. You started giving Islamic answers to your points.
Like
they have built in talking points that work. There's a built in quote unquote logical nature to the religion. The Quran itself, when you read an English translation, because most of the Muslims at these mosques, they didn't know what the Quran meant, but I knew what it meant because I read it in English. When you read it in English, it has this kind of unique flow that you've never read before. So Islam is the best at terms of having these built-in things to reel you in. I'm definitely going to, I mean, it's a totally different topic. I'm definitely disputing the vegan thing and thing. I just, I don't think there's anything positive. I don't think there's anything positive about pork, about a pig. I mean, I don't think there really isn't. But you go to the point of that religion was probably good for the time. Like,
do you think do you think pork is uniquely bad compared to other meats? Like beef, for example?
I'm really not an expert, but for me to have a religion have it in there so specifically and have this idea of God knowing what's best to put in your body, I think that just is attractive.
Is there evidence for that? Like, for example,
I think they're probably with any, I mean, if you look at any of these diet shows or stuff, I watch a lot of them, there's evidence for everything. You could find evidence that coffee is good for you, evidence that coffee is bad for you. You could find the Warriors with the vegan diet. You could find Jordan Peterson on a carnivore diet doing fine. I think there is a good amount of evidence, and you brought up a few of the maybe things grandma tells you, pigs eat their own shit. I mean, you probably brought up a few of the things. I think there probably is evidence both ways. I'm no expert, but the fact that religion does offer these things in Islam, you could have an imam give you a 1-hour lecture, as they like to call it, a lecture about why pigs are bad and have all these hadiths and all these things, and it gives the illusion of like a mathematical proof. X is Y because Y is Z, and Z plus Y. And when you listen to Mufti Meng do this for an hour, it's like, pigs are bad. Dang, I'm an idiot. I got to stop eating pigs. I'm going to stay up late and do my extra prayer. God, you know, Allah, please, you know. Yeah. Islam has these built-in little answers that I think are really good. They work for them to work on me.
Yeah.
Thinking back, I'm like, damn, I'm actually like, I think I'm a pretty smart guy. For this religion to pull this on me, and I sit with my mom now, and I'm like, dang. Can you believe what I went through? Like, I cannot believe this religion worked on me. I mean, it's very impressive. And I clearly still like some things, as you see, about Islam. I mean, there is a certain thing there. That's why these religions survive. It's not just the built-in mechanism. I think it works. But there is an innate sense of the human being search for the deity that humanism cannot present. And the fact that you offer that godhood, I think, is very important. And that's why these religions survive, especially the monotheistic ones. I think they've just characterized the human experience for so long. There is a reason there.
Well, so you know what I think? So I was watching this Malcolm X documentary, Who Killed Malcolm X, and there was something there was something very interesting to me that stood out. One of the Nation of Islam members, now everyone would agree that Nation of Islam, all Muslims would agree that Nation of Islam is a false religion. It's not a true religion. Elijah Muhammad was never a prophet. But I found this so interesting. The guy, one of the members, I don't remember his name. He was one of the, I think he might have worked for the FBI, but he was in The Nation and he sincerely believed in Elijah Muhammad. And he went to an Indian buffet and he's like, the messenger teaches us not to eat lima bean. Oh, I forgot what type of beans it was. And we only eat, like, for example, pigeon peas, for example, or channa, whatever it's called. And I was like, whoa, that's weird. Like, you can't eat this type of beans, but you can eat this type of beans. And I feel like us humans, we want that. We want someone to tell us, don't do this, do this. And that actually is a type of mental programming as well, right? I feel like telling someone, don't eat pork, is a way of making them, you know, kind of be in line with you and to follow you. That's what I think. Because it's interesting that they do that too. They make these artificial reasons.
Well, Islam is better at that than Christianity. And that's why I went. That's why a lot of Christians go to Islam, because Christians, you will sit there during your teenage years and badger your priests for answers. Yeah. There's no answers. Christianity is so nebulous. Jesus is love.
Yeah.
God is the Trinity. Christianity doesn't have these books, these huge theological traditions. Christianity was a religion of dumb European peasants. I mean, Christianity during, you know, we were shit in the plague. I mean, Islam has more academia, is more tradition of logic. You read the Quran, it says, question me, answer me, bring a proof. Christianity, the idea is not to have an answer. I'm getting really fired up because it's bringing back these old memories. Yeah. The reasons why Christians go to Islam is because Christianity doesn't have even the first semblance of a way to answer these deep questions. You don't have these Mufti Menk figures in Christianity. You might have a few, but Islam is jam-packed with these little logical proofs, and it really is impressive from the inside and the outside, I think.
I feel a lot of the modern apologists, though, the
and Islam presents, it's that talking point. It's like the complete way of life, right?
Yeah.
Islam, and that's what Christians always want. This is the complete way of life. Finally, we explain what all the prophets are talking about. Jesus was a prophet. This is the complete answer. Sure, I'll eat with my right hand. Yeah, I'll wipe my ass with my hand. Yeah, if this is the complete answer, that's all right. I'll stay up late during. This is the complete way. Muhammad was the answer. The formula works, man. It's scary. And if you're listening, and if I'm making you, you know, start to think about liking Islam, don't listen, because this is all snake oil.
So let's finish up now. Let's talk.
Yeah, I got to get going. And thank you so much for the opportunity. This was really great to talk about. We could definitely wrap it up, man.
Awesome. Any last thoughts? Do you want to share anything else about your journey just before we get going?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talked kind of sporadically about the kind of music aspect.
Yeah.
I think that's just a very important point when we end, is that that's probably the main reason I really made the decision to leave Islam, is that not only music, everybody and all the Muslims listening, you know that there are these weird doctrines that you don't understand, that you've been doing since you were a kid. Girls, you know that you've been putting that thing on your head for years. Guys, you know that you're watering your asshole all the time and you're sitting down to pee when your friends are using urinals. Like guys, like, you know there are these weird things in Islam, and most Muslims, myself included, would just kind of develop weird talking points or things like that to survive them or believe them. But guys, really think deeply about these things, and you could release your potential as a human. When I was able to finally release that freedom from the music being haram, you know, I was able to kind of boost my music career to the top. And now, you know, I have a great career as a musician. And don't let religion or don't let anything or any weird doctrine bring you down. Girls, don't let your boys, don't let your parents tell you you have to be a doctor or an engineer. You know, girls, don't let your parents force you to marry your cousin. Like, you know, there are these weird doctrines, and you can still love the decent doctrines of the religion and criticize a lot of these doctrines, because a lot of these hadith books and a lot of these doctrines, that's not what Islam is about, folks. And I tried to be very positive in this little podcast here. I want the end message to be that all these little weird doctrines that we critique are all from hadith and all from these strange traditions that were created by men. My criticisms of Christianity are issues of man-made Bible changing, man-made, you know, the hadith have been edited through time, but deep down, you can still appreciate the decent parts of these religions, and all the monotheistic religions have a very simple message. And I still believe I'm a spiritual person. I would love to go to some kind of heaven, but I believe in, you know, there is some kind of higher power. You know, these monotheistic beliefs, believe in a God, be a good person, maybe do a little fasting, give a little charity, you know, study a few of the prophets, see how they live their life, you know, be open. Trust women, be nice to your mom, be nice to your family, support the poor. These are these universal ideas. You don't have to be ashamed to critique some of these strange doctrines. Like, yeah, you know, helping the poor is a good thing, but why exactly can't I eat that delicious bacon cheeseburger from Burger King? You know, it's okay, folks, to question these things and still be a decent person. And nowadays, I think both Christianity and Islam are being liberalized to the extreme. There are so many of these liberal Muslims, and it's funny, most of them attack you, and these people that attack you, I'm like, are you even Muslim? What are you talking? Like, you're partying, and like, there are so many liberal Muslims you can hang out with. There are liberal Christians. If you're really attached to it, you can kind of divorce yourself from the, stay away from fundamentalism, stay away from the Hadith books, stay away from the man-made text, and get down to what I call the big ideas. And yeah, it was great. Music is not haram. Listen to music. Music is great, but you know, music with swears is probably not too good. But listen to, I study classical music.
Yeah.
There are Arabs all over the world that never heard Mozart or Beethoven.
Yeah.
Sit and listen to some Bach. You know, that Keanu Reeves movie when he was an alien, you know, when he came to destroy the world, he sat and they were playing a bit of Bach classical music. And he said, wow, that's beautiful. If you're a human and you've never heard the good classical music, play it. Come on, Muslims, listen to some Mozart. It'll change your life. You know, listen to these Western works we're talking about. And white folks listening, study a little bit of these, you know, Islamic greats, you know, and don't be so into your atheism too, because that's a religion as well. You know, be open to all sorts of ideas, because you got a great channel. You bring in a lot of atheists too. You bring in a lot of religious people, and it's cool that you kind of are like the uncle of us all. You kind of just keep us all in line.
Thank you so much. I mean, this has been the first kind of interview I've done in a long time, so I apologize for taking so long to get it set up. Definitely, thank you so much. That was a beautiful way to end. I just want to say one thing, which is, some people will say, oh, look at this guy, he's leaving Islam because music is haram. That's a tangential issue. That's something I got called out on my Dulkarnain Gate issue. Oh, he's leaving Islam for a tangential issue that's not part of the five pillars. The thing is, if any single tangential issue is wrong in Islam, that makes the whole thing wrong, because Islam has to be either true or not true. So don't, you know, criticize him, because he's not saying, you know, John's not saying, I left Islam because I wanted to listen to music, because he was already involved in music even before leaving Islam.
And I was involved in Islamic music.
Exactly. So the whole package was the issue. But I definitely appreciate, this was a great conversation. Thank you so much, John. I guess you don't go by Yahya anymore. Probably not.
Call me whatever you want.
All right, brother.
Habibi.
Peace, brother. And hopefully we'll have you again for a follow-up, maybe in a couple of years or a couple of months, and we'll see how things are going.
Yeah.
Some good new reflections, if we could talk about some current events or something.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love current events. Folks, you can follow me on Twitter. I do a lot of politics,
yes,
a lot of music, all sorts of stuff. You could just look up John Del Vento. That's my name. You'll find all the Twitter. And thank you again. You have a great channel. Good luck with it.
Thank you so much. I will be sharing John's Twitter handle. Is that the best way to find you on Twitter?
Twitter's the social media I'm really active on. I don't do Instagram or any of that. But,
okay.
Yeah, so you can listen to my music all over the place, you know, as well. Google's great.
So now when I'm watching a movie, I will be thanking you because it probably has a scene from your work. All right, everyone, that's it. Thank you so much, and see you again. Bye.
Consider sharing this video and helping me to make more such videos. My link to my support page is below. Your support keeps the light on my channel. This is your friendly neighborhood ex-Muslim signing out.